You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 11th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Happy Monday, folks. What a weekend. Friday night, we averted a shutdown of the federal government on the backs of the middle class and the poor. It was, we were told, historic and a victory for all of us who have been looking forward to this oncoming austerity, which is proving to be so disastrous just as it's being implemented in the UK. And we will be talking to Digby from the blog Hullabaloo today on the implications of this deal and, frankly, the implications of the way the Democrats are attempting to spin it. Before we get there, not good news from Wisconsin. Last we left you, as you recall, on Friday, we played a pre-recorded show. We will have plenty to talk about in the post-show. A lot of people took real issue with Chris Rosen on his review of Who's the Caboose and his apparent complete lack of knowledge of John Cassavetes. But be that as it may, we will get to that later in the program. Out of Wisconsin, last we left you, Kloppenburg, the Democrat, was up by about 200 votes with an election of in Wisconsin for the Supreme Court, 1.5 million votes approximately, up by 200, destined for a recount late Thursday night, I should say Thursday afternoon perhaps. The Waukesha, Wisconsin County Clerk, Republican Kathy Nicholas, reported that she forgot to save some voting data when she was transferring it from her personal computer. And as a result, the votes of an entire, mostly Republican town were not recorded.
Hey, what happened?
And it basically gave Kathy Nicholas's, oh, you should know, she used to work for David Prosser. That's just a coincidence. It gave him an additional 7,500 plus votes. 7,580, I think it was. And just to give you a little background on this Nicholas, she is a partisan Republican operative. She worked for Prosser during the 90s. When he was the Republican leader of the Wisconsin State Assembly. She was an employee of the Republican caucus. Apparently, she had some trouble with state officials. She was audited after she moved official data to her personal computers. This seems to be a pattern for her. The Wisconsin State Journal said that last summer, the Waukesha County Board ordered an internal audit of her office, citing concerns that Nicholas was secretive and refusing to cooperate with the county's technical staff in a security review of the computerized election system. State election officials combed through Waukesha County election results on Friday, but as of yet have not agreed to the calls that they examine the individual ballots. Kevin Kennedy, director of the State Government Accountability Board, was sent to Waukesha County to verify the results after Thursday. He saw the thousands of previously tabulated votes go to Prosser. He questioned why Waukesha County Clerk had waited more than a day to inform him and the public of the error. That's a good question. He said state officials would not be checking the ballots. They are not necessarily handwritten, but they're hand filled out. They're not going to check them before any possible recount. It would seem at this point that the win by Prosser is still within the margin in which the state would pay for a recount. It is unclear. I guess he's up by about 6,700 votes. This is obviously a big margin to make up in a recount, but we will see. Everybody's lawyered up, and we just don't know what's going to happen going forward. Obviously, a loss by Kloppenburg would dramatically affect the makeup of the court, or would dramatically maintain the makeup of the court. I don't think it diminishes from the actual outpouring of energy from people in Wisconsin. But this is obviously a bit of a problem. We will keep you updated with this. Meanwhile, Friday night, actually technically the government was shut down for, 15, 20 minutes, half an hour. A deal was struck essentially to keep the federal government funded for a week. The broad outlines of the cuts were agreed upon. We're still waiting to see the details of those cuts. We're starting to see some trickle in. But it cut almost $39 billion. If you use spending in 2010 as a starting point, which was about $78-79 billion below what Obama asked for his budget. And it was actually more. The cuts were greater, about $6.5 billion more than Speaker Boehner's first proposal back in February. It didn't reach the $100 million number that the Tea Party wanted, missed it by about a little over $20 billion. The riders that the Republicans want, at least most of them, defunding Planned Parenthood, NPR, a litany of these riders basically specifying where the cuts would go that had nothing really to do with the budget, had more to do with the so-called fiscally responsible Tea Partiers' cultural war. Did not make it. However, one or two did for the District of Columbia. I'll get to that in a moment. Slightly half the cuts came from parts of the budget other than non-discretionary spending. Saved things, theoretically, like Pell Grants and Head Start. And the most, I guess, distressing part of the whole experience was to hear Obama talk about it as a victory, to hear Harry Reid talk about it as historic, and not in a pejorative way. Watergate was also historic. Vietnam, also historic. And this is just the beginning, folks. We now have the debt ceiling and the 2012 budget fights ahead of us. Some details still coming in. Republicans and Democrats are still haggling over this. They'll be doing this over the course of the next week. Democrats said, like I had mentioned, they mitigated proposed cuts to key education and health programs. New York Times has a window into the agreement at this point, just coming out today. $13 billion from programs at the Departments of Labor, Education, Health, and Human Services would extract $1 billion more in an across-the-board cut from domestic agencies. There will be reductions to housing assistance programs and some health care programs, along with $8 billion in cuts to the State Department and foreign aid. It's not like there's much going on the foreign policy front that would affect national security going forward in any way. It would cut more than $2 billion for, set aside for the creation of a private nonprofit health insurance cooperatives. This is, again, Republicans' attack on the Affordable Care Act. It also eliminates programs that would have allowed hundreds of thousands of lower-income workers to opt out of employer-sponsored health plans and use the employer's contribution to buy coverage on their own through new insurance exchanges. Ryan Grimm over Twitter over the weekend said that the deal also denies funding for additional IRS agents. A perfect example has this, how this has nothing to do with the deficit. We know that for every dollar spent on IRS enforcement, you get 10 back. There would be a run on certificate of deposits if it gave you half that return. I think if you lock your money up for 3 years now, you get 2% return on that. Unbelievable. And as far as these policy riders, there's at least one, and this is just lovely. It's a ban on the District of Columbia's government-funded abortions. In other words, no help for poor women who want to maintain some sovereignty over their body. You'll have to head to Virginia, I guess, or to Maryland. If you don't have a car, you're just forced to have that child. And it also renews a private school voucher plan. And Washington, of course, coming on the heels of this scandal that showed Michelle Ray. Well, someone once told me I was mispronouncing that. Maybe it's Ree. I don't know. Basically oversaw the fudging of scores that showed that the schools were improving significantly. Obama, quote, making the largest annual spending cut in our history. Harry Reid, again, calling them historic. Here's what's so effed up about this. This is from ABC's This Week. This is Ron Brownstein of the National Journal questioning whether or not it was a Democratic victory and exactly why it is a Republican victory. And this is not just about, you know, a baseball game here. This is not just about it's a victory because one team won or another. There are real implications to this. We are in the midst of a recession. We still have 8.8% unemployment. That doesn't even include those 99ers who have been kicked off the rolls. And you're cutting spending. Austerity at a time of recession. Well,
we'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover, for really showing us the way.
Here's Ron Brownstein.
Substantively, I think it's clearly a victory for the Republicans. The entire debate, as George suggested, was on their terms. The Democrats, the president, essentially accepted an argument that austerity was acceptable at a time when unemployment is still 8.8%. That is a big win. The other big thing, I think, substantively, is that Republicans come out of this more united, Mike Pence notwithstanding, and I think Democrats come out more divided. I think that by and large the feeling in the Republican caucus is that John Boehner was able to get a pretty good deal for them while holding them together and avoiding going off the cliff the way they did in 95 by shutting down the government, whereas the Democrats are a little more uncertain about where President Obama will draw a line, when he will be with him, and when he won't. Politically, it's a little bit of a different story. I think all incumbents benefit from accomplishment in divided government, so the president is on firmer ground there. But substantively, I think this was a very strong outcome for the Republicans.
I'm not sure what the value of a political win is if this is what we're going to get. And here's Chrystia Freeland. She's of Thomson Reuters, used to be the Washington editor for the Financial Times. And, well, no screaming liberal, but she sees it for what it is. Play this.
What I think was missing, Donna, and, you know, I'd love to hear you expand on this is Democrats actually arguing that the recovery is incredibly fragile, unemployment is high, and it's not about, I mean, Plouffe was saying to you, Christiane, that it's actually a question of, well, if you make cuts in the right way, then that's okay. There is an argument to be made, and if anyone makes it, it should be the Democrats, that says, don't make cuts right now. Yes, the budget is a problem, but it's a medium-term problem. And right now, when the economy is on the ropes, let's remember you have oil prices skyrocketing because of the Middle East, you have Japan. Right now is a time when actually we should still be talking about government spending.
They conceded an important predicate, I mean, going forward into this next debate.
Huge.
I mean, they have basically not drawn the line, as Chris just said, they have not drawn the line in saying this is not the time to be retrenching, so that when you begin this bigger debate, I mean, this is the foothills to the Himalayan debate that's coming over the overall budget and the Paul Ryan plan. It's going to be harder for them, I think, to come back and say, look, we shouldn't be talking about withdrawing federal spending at a moment when the economy is so weak, because they clearly did not make that argument here.
And there's a strong argument to make, because they could say, so far, actually, it's working. And just look across the ocean, look across the Atlantic. The Brits have imposed budgetary austerity, and their economy is shrinking even faster than they thought.
That's right. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby from the blog Hullabaloo. Still probably drunk from celebrating this huge historic victory. We'll be right back after this. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. The great Digby from the blog Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Digby, hopefully you've sobered up since the massive celebration on this historic, once-in-a-lifetime type of austerity plan, essentially, that was passed. And it's really the first of many, isn't it?
Oh, I can hardly wait. I am so excited. These next few months, it's just going to be one party after another. The thrill of watching a Democratic president announce the most historic spending cuts in history is just, it's too much for me. I barely was able to function all weekend. I was so excited about it.
Yes, I can only imagine. All right, well, let's break this down. I mean, we're not sure exactly of the cuts, but you know, we know at least $13 billion of them are going to come from things like health care and affordable housing. You know, silly stuff that has no impact on anybody's lives. We're going to be cutting from the State Department, thank God, because it's not like anything's happening overseas. But what's the worst aspect of all of this for you?
Well, you know, I mean, for me, I think it's probably there are two things. One is that, you know, this is the worst time for many individual human beings to have money taken from programs that they actually need. I mean, this is happening, you know, around the country. This is immediate. This is the 2011 budget. So it's not like this is something, you know, 20, 30 years from now, don't worry, we'll fix it in conference kind of thing. I mean, this is serious stuff, and it's going to happen right now at a time when most people really can't afford it. And, you know, on the greater macroeconomic side of this, which I think it should be something that the Democrats and particularly the president should be concerned about, is the fact that, you know, withdrawing money from the economy in big sums like this at this point in this very fragile recovery is extremely dangerous and could easily result in a slowdown of what, you know, tepid growth we have. Certainly at a time of 8.8% unemployment, it's almost unconscionable that they're doing it, and it's totally counterproductive to whatever the Democrats and Obama should be doing on a political basis. So I honestly don't see any upside. I can't find anything about it that makes sense to me, either on a political or on a policy level. This is just, it's as if there's some mania. I feel like it's like the Salem witch trial, and everybody in Washington has been taken over by some form of mass hysteria. It's absurd, and I don't know. I mean, I get on the sort of minor political level why the president would cave. These people were behaving like kamikazes and basically saying that they were willing to shut down the government, which would have also been extremely bad. But just on a sort of objective level, either politically or policy, I don't see why. It's kind of hard to look back and go, well, how the hell did we get here? I mean, this is absurd.
There's sort of two elements to the political argument here. I mean, one is the politics of good policy, and one is the politics of I guess maybe there's three. There's the politics of good policy. There's the politics of the reelection chances for Congress members and for the Senate, and there's the politics of Obama and his reelection chances. Let's take first what I think is the most disturbing part, is this politics of policy, because we are looking at two more fights like this at least, right? I mean, we're looking at the debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling, and we're looking at the 2012 budget. And it seems to me that the predicate of what makes for good policy in this situation, the idea that you need government to spend when you're in the midst of a recession, are completely out the window now.
Oh, it's gone. I mean, the Democrats gave that up completely. That any idea of trying to explain Keynesian economics, which granted is counterintuitive at first blush, you know, it doesn't seem like something that would make sense to a lot of people if they haven't thought it through. But it's not impossible to explain it. It makes perfect sense when you do it as Franklin Roosevelt did, which is just, look, I'm here to rescue people, and we're going to do that. People come first, and that's how we're going to do it. And people, you know, can understand that. But yeah, they've given up that argument entirely. And in fact, with Obama coming out and taking credit for the most historic spending cuts in history over the weekend, which was mind-boggling to me. It was one thing to do the capitulation, but as Paul Waldman wrote this morning in the American Prospect, he said that, you know, the understandable way to have done that would have been for the president to come out and say, look, this was not something I wanted to do. These people were holding the government hostage. They were ready to shut down the government. I couldn't let that happen. But let me tell you, this is not the way to do things. This is the wrong way to do it. I do not support it. And let me, you know, and blame them for the consequences of this. Because what's going to happen here? I mean, he could get lucky. Maybe the economy is going to come roaring back at an unprecedented pace, and everybody will be down to 6% unemployment by 2012, and you know, it'll be morning in America. Maybe he'll get that lucky. But boy, that's a big risk to take, because what's happening now is that he just bought this. He bought this, whatever the economy, you know, whatever's happening now, that, you know, spending cuts are very likely to cause at least a slowdown in growth. If you look at what's happening over in the UK, they just did an austerity program, and they are cutting back all of their projections now. It's bad, and unlike the rest of Europe, which didn't do what they did. And it looks as though we're prepared to do that, too. So the politics of this, which, you know, his future is tied to the results. You know, this is what presidents are held. They've got 4 years. People look back and go, this is, you know, how'd you do? And they make their assessment based on that. It's not, you know, if the economy's doing really well and everything goes great, then he probably will coast to victory. And he probably will anyway, if only for the fact that the Republicans have no viable candidates, really. But it's a big chance to take, because if the economy does not improve, and the Republicans put forward even, you know, a walking mannequin like Mitt Romney, it could be tighter than he wants. And meanwhile, you know, let's destroy liberalism in the prospect.
Well, exactly.
Let's destroy the future of America in the process.
Haven't they managed to basically say that It's going to be impossible for a generation now to argue the most sound economic policies when you're faced with a crisis like we're in.
Yes, and what they've done is they've basically said, in a time of economic, of lack of growth, or in the worst case, in a recession or a depression, we need to cut spending. The exact opposite, and that is going to be the prescription. That's always been what Republicans wanted to do. I mean, you know, Andrew Mellon, back in 1929 or 1930, he was advising Hoover to say, you know, that, well, we'll wring all the excess out of the economy and, you know, this will be good for us. Well, it's always good for people who have a lot of money. Unfortunately, the rest of the people have a little bit of a problem. And now we're kind of stuck with this. It's going to take twice as much. And it's not like it was easy to convince people to spend money in a downturn anyway. You know, they've been propagandized for the last 30 years against taxes and spending and everything. So it's not easy anyway, but now it's going to be impossible. The Democrats have more or less officially adopted this line. And the danger in it is that what the Republicans have also managed to do as part of this propaganda campaign is convince people that the reason that we're having this downturn is because of government spending. Mm-hmm. They're saying there's a cause and effect. Boy, that's dangerous. I mean, you know, this means that no matter what happens, and this is their dream come true, of course, cut taxes and cut spending. Under all circumstances, when the economy's rolling, let's cut taxes and cut spending. We know that because we don't want to, you know, contract the economy. And now we need to do it in a downturn, too. Very, very dangerous stuff. And it just seems like such an incredibly short-term strategy on the part of the president and the Democrats to do this.
We're not even taking into account, because immediately, literally starting Wednesday, Obama comes out with, I guess, what will be his proposal for, or I guess he's calling it his plan to reduce the deficit.
Right.
And I guess presumably it also has implications for the 2012 budget. People have been talking about Paul Ryan's budget as essentially a joke. Even David Stockman, the former Reagan budget director, said this is a joke. Paul Ryan's his budget is an absolute joke, but we're going to have Obama supposedly coming out on this. Wednesday night could be his grand bargain proposal, isn't it?
I'm assuming that's what we're going to see, and I'm assuming that it will more or less follow the outlines of the aborted deficit commission, the cat food commission. It wasn't even their report. I should just call it, you know, Bull Simpson, which is what it is, or Simpson Bulls, I guess they call it. I think that's pretty much what we're going to see. And keep in mind that they're going to say, hey, look, you know, it's all okay because he's going to ask for tax hikes. So that's, you know, that means that it's good news for you. Now, here's the essential logical problem with that. We need tax hikes because we have to pay down the deficit. But in the grand bargain, we're going to get tax hikes and we're going to get benefit cuts that are not necessary. Those things are not necessary. We need the tax hikes to pay down the deficit. And what we're going to see instead is a trade-off. The trade-off is tax hikes for deficit reduction. The end, goodbye. We don't really need to do any of the rest of that. That is absolutely insane. You know, Medicare, sure, there needs to be discussions about that. It should not come out of the hides of actual human beings. That's not necessary. Nobody else does that. The rest of the world, there's lots of first world countries that are managing to contain their costs way better than we are and give better care. So this idea that they're going to come out with this, with, I think, the Simpson-Bowles plan or some kind of rough outline. And we always knew that was going to be the baseline for negotiation. Ryan coming out when he did with his was a very shrewd move. And he's kind of an interesting character because he was willing to do that and take the heat on the right, and I think he'll be rewarded for it big time down the road. He's got a very, very illustrious career ahead of him.
Because he's basically just opened up, he's essentially widened the playing field from the center to the
right. Hugely. And now, I mean, last week, I don't know, nobody noticed this, but the Republican governors came out with a plan that made Ryan look sane by comparison. So they're just pushing this far, you know, as far out as they possibly can. And, you know, this is a good, this, what it did was it opened up the political space for Simpson Bowles to be seen as, you know, the day that Ryan's plan came out, you know, Ezra Klein wrote, well, how long before, you know, soon liberals will see that the Simpson Bowles plan is actually very reasonable by comparison.
Right, of course. And so what we're going to see is we're going to see attempts to raise taxes. We're going to see cuts maybe to Social Security, certainly to aspects of Medicaid and Medicare. Mm-hmm. You're going to have old people who are not going to be able to afford their hospice living there. And we're going to basically see some type of redistribution again of the wealth moving upward, because as we cut Social Security, it's been funded by the middle class predominantly, and we're going to there's no way these tax increases that he's going to propose very likely won't ever get passed, but they won't make up for what we're going to take from the cuts from middle class.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you know, and you know, we need to keep our eye on a couple of other things too. They're going to talk a lot about closing tax loopholes, and you know, getting rid of some of the exemptions and what have you. That is really chimera. I mean, when you're talking about reforming the tax code, as specifically the corporate taxes, which they want to if Simpson Bowles is the baseline, they want to lower corporate tax rates. But at the same time, allegedly close all these loopholes that will mean that we'll, you know, more magic where we'll get more revenue with, you know, by opening, by closing loopholes. You know, they employ armies of accountants to ensure that doesn't happen. And they employ armies of lobbyists to ensure that loopholes are created
Right. These are the people, these people who are now exploiting these loopholes are going to be the ones who are going to be helping write the new tax code.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the kind of thing that's way too arcane and difficult for average people to understand. So it's an easily exploitable, giveaway that the politicians can pretend that they're actually doing something and not actually do it. That's something I would be very, very, you know, surprised if anything substantial comes out of. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff around the edges that sound good that could come out of this discussion on Wednesday that one would have to look at with something of a jaundiced eye, because I think that in the end what, as far as I'm concerned, and the position that I take on this is, no, we're not going to do any of this. We're going to reinstate the Bush tax cuts. That they go first, let's see what happens then.
Let me ask you this. I mean, and we only have a couple of minutes left here. Maybe there's not enough time to get into this type of the conversation. But what do we do? I mean, what do progressives, liberals, I'm not even sure the value of that word anymore, frankly, in terms of when we talk about things like taxation and government spending, because, you know, our socialist president has decided to throw Keynesian economics down into the heap, waste heap. But what do we do? I mean, is there a point in where we can sort of win this politically? Is it simply just trying to educate people? I mean, we keep losing ground here.
Well, I wish I had the answer. I don't know. I mean, in this particular series of negotiations that are going to happen over the next year, I think that the main thing to do is just scream like hell. I don't know what else you can do besides that. And try to organize ourselves. There are a lot of things that are sort of happening, like the Main Street Project, which is working on kind of organizing people around the idea of, it's sort of a broad-based concept.
U.S. Uncut.
Yeah.
I mean, there are
U.S. Uncut. There's some other things that are worth, I think, spending time, you know, devoting a little time to, paying very close attention to what's really going on. There's going to be an election campaign, and that's always a good time. Politicians have to open themselves up to the people, and when that happens, if we're armed with questions, armed with the right kind of commentary, perhaps we can move the dial a little bit.
Is there an electoral strategy? I mean, you know, people are again talking about the idea of primarying Obama. I don't know who this candidate is that's going to be able to primary Obama, but I mean, is there some type of electoral strategy? I mean,
well, on the presidential race, I would be shocked if anything comes of that idea. One would think that you could do it with having a left flank as unhappy as this one is. And granted, it's not the base of the party, but it is the flank. It is the it's the liberal flank, and it's the vanguard of the Democratic Party. They shouldn't take that for granted. They shouldn't assume that that's something that doesn't matter, because the kind of people who are unhappy are opinion leaders and people who can make a difference. It's not irrelevant that the left is unhappy. And under those circumstances, you would think that there would be something. But nobody, I just don't see anybody challenging an historic president like Barack Obama. I just don't see that. I think that would be a very disruptive kind of thing to do. It's possible, and I think that everyone will decide how they feel about that depending on the person that does it. But as far as another electoral strategy is, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, aside from sort of considering how to do some of these, you know, more guerrilla-type tactics and working with outside movement-type groups like Uncut, U.S. Uncut, would be, you know, doing the kind of things. I work with a political PAC, Blue America, with Down with Tyranny and Crooks and Liars, and we raise money for progressives and raise money for campaigns that go right up into the faces of some of these people, Democrats and Republicans alike. They don't like us very much. We're very, you know, we're very unpopular among the establishment types. But we think it's important to do it, and it gives grassroots and netroots participants a place to go within the electoral system. I mean, and that's difficult at the moment. I mean, I have to say, there was a time when, you know, just saying more and better Democrats seemed like a great thing to say, and now everybody's kind of going, really? That's the best we can do, Democrats?
Exactly. Well,
so it's getting a little bit harder.
Digby from the blog Hullabaloo, thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully we'll talk again soon on a less celebratory occasion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, next time maybe when I'm calmed down, we can... we can talk about other things.
All right, thanks.
Right now, I'm just so happy. Thanks,
yes,
Sam.
I can tell. Me too. All right, we got to take a break. Bye. We'll be right back. A couple more stories before we go into the post show. Oh, we'll take your phone calls. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks. Well, there it is. Wednesday, we're going to hear from Obama laying out a spending plan. That should be fun. It should be really fun. That should be really super fun. One story of interest that I wanted to touch on. Oh, just to give you a brief update, it appears in the Ivory Coast that I don't even know why I say this. The former leader.
Gbagbo.
According to Reuters, has been detained and arrested by the French. Gbagbo obviously was refused to abide by the election results, and the French went in there, special ops, and they're now basically have him arrested. We will keep you updated on that. Meanwhile, Libyan government forces have continued to shell the rebel-held city of Misrata, despite the fact that mediators had announced from the African Union that Gaddafi had accepted their ceasefire proposal. So it continues there. We shall see what's going on. We'll give you more of an update tomorrow. Want to just touch on this story. It's out of the LA Times. It's about IKEA. It's an interesting story because it gives you a sense of just how we are viewed by corporate America in this country. IKEA is, and it's a Swedish company. You can go there, you can get Swedish meatballs, you get very, very cheap, but designery type of furniture. I would imagine both Matt and Evan heavily rely on IKEA.
Yep. Yes, you do.
Usually I just pick IKEA furniture out of the garbage.
There you go. Yeah. Well, one way or another, that's fine. I think everything that Nikki and I own is either from is probably all from IKEA or something that I got at a yard sale years ago. But it's interesting. 3 years ago, they opened up a factory in Danville, Virginia. Now, IKEA in Sweden, it's owned by Swedwood. Maybe Swedwood, I don't know. Totally unionized. Much of the labor force in Sweden is unionized. And IKEA is very much cherished by the Swedes. They love their IKEA. In Danville, Virginia, it is the target of racial discrimination complaints, a heated union organizing battle, and a lot of turnover from disgruntled employees. According to the LA Times, workers complain of eliminated raises, a frenzied pace, and mandatory overtime. Several said it's common to find out on Friday evening that they'll have to pull a weekend shift with disciplinary action for those who can't or don't show up. You remember that from the shirtwaist factory? If you don't work on Sunday, don't show up on Monday. Some of Virginia's plant's 335 workers are trying to form a union. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers said a majority of eligible employees had signed cards expressing interest. In response, the factory has hired union-busting law firms to come in and start organizing meetings to disparage the union, to scare people. Swedwood spokeswoman Ingrid, I can't do a Swedish accent, called the situation in Danville sad. But she said she could not discuss the complaints of specific employees. She said that she had heard rumors about anti-union meetings at the plant, but added, quote, this wouldn't be anything that would be approved by the group management in Sweden. Yeah, we do things different in Sweden. But it's front page news in Sweden where much of the labor force is unionized, like I said. And Per Olaf Sjö, the head of the Swedish union in Swedwood factory, said he was baffled by the friction in Danville. IKEA's code of conduct, known as IVE, guarantees workers the right to organize and stipulates that all overtime be voluntary. But that's in Sweden. Yeah. Laborers in Swedwood plants in Sweden produce bookcases and tables similar to those manufactured in Danville. The big difference is that Europeans enjoy a minimum wage of about $19 an hour and a government-mandated 5 weeks of paid vacation. These people are evil. They are trying to destroy the world. The horror. The horror. That's why we're so much better than Sweden, because we don't have mandated 5 week vacations where everybody would be running around. What do we do? What would we do? $19 an hour. Full-time employees in Danville start at $8 an hour with, are you ready for this? A whole 12 vacation days. Wow. Eight of them on dates determined by the company.
What?
Yeah, so you get like Christmas and New Year, they tell you. You get 4 whole days a year to schedule your vacation days. Not to mention mandatory overtime. So on Friday night, you know those plans you had for the weekend? Oh, I was going to take my kid to the doctor. No,
I don't think so.
As many as one-third of the workers at Danville plant have been drawn from local temporary staffing agencies. They receive even lower wages and no benefits, employees said. No Swedish meatballs. You'll be lucky if you get to $8 an hour. Bill Street, who has been trying to organize the Danville workers for the Machinist Union, said, "It's ironic that IKEA looks on the U.S. and Danville the way most people in the U.S. look at Mexico."
We'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover, for really showing us the way.
And just in case you were wondering, the median hourly wage in the Danville area is $15.48. And the company made 6.1% bigger profits last year than they did in 2009. The difference between what we have in Sweden, versus in Danville, most of the managers are American.
Come with me, and you'll
living your fantasy
in a world
in the IKEA
in
Danville.
Take a look.
Can you imagine there's some place where people get 5 weeks mandatory vacation? Up to $16, $19 an hour?
With a spin.
That must be horrible.
In the world
all right,
of
folks.
Creation.
See you on the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call if we get the calls working. We're having little problems, I think. At 646-257-3920. We're going to still work out the bugs on the calling system. Thursday was a little test. Folks, please, if you can become a Majority Report member, please do so. Please. We need your support badly. Also, don't forget our Amazon link and, of course, justcoffee.coop. 10% off. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Fair trade. Coffee. Tea. Chocolate. Got to lay off the chocolate. I've got to lay off the chocolate. You're not sitting on your butt 9 hours a day in front of a microphone like I am. You don't need to lay off the chocolate. I do. All right, I'll take your IMs at Majority FM. See you tomorrow.